brightest students to the profession. If you ever wanted to be a teacher, the time is now. Amazing things are happening in teaching today. Find out more at teach.org.
90.1 KPFT Houston.
It is Thursday, 8 p.m., and time for So, What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted to storytelling, and you're going to find it only on KPFT, Houston's Community Radio. Good evening. I am your host and producer, Hank Rubicek, and along with the best team on radio, Greg Audell, Warren Holloman, Mary Edgerton, Tatiana Gago, Eric Kane, Chrissy Gorman, and Harwood Taylor, we celebrate the power of story by inviting storytellers to take us on astonishing journeys through windows of their souls. You know, most of us have a favorite romantic scene in a movie. Mine is a restless Tom Cruise running in a rainstorm, running with the desperation of someone who escaped from prison until he reaches his destination, his high school gymnasium, where his girlfriend, played by Kara Sedgwick, is sadly dancing with another guy. A silk-clad Cruise walks over to his gal as prom-goers part like the sea for Moses. Her dud date slowly leaves and they embrace, Cruise and Kara, slow dancing to Moon River. All of this the night before he shipped off to Vietnam in Bourne on the 4th of July. It's a story, a song that makes the moment. And this is what we're all about tonight as we enjoy a select compilation from the sappy stories from our So What's Your Story collection, along with a few songs to complete the romantic images told so beautifully by our spotlight tellers. We're going to throw in a few fresh ingredients like love letters and a ditty or two, and we've got the perfect formula for February, the month we celebrate love. But you know, it's best to start with the basics. Chemistry. There ain't no love without it. And this clever narrative, told by our dear friend Michael Winters, serves up a whole new formula.
Mrs. Burns, my fifth grade teacher, was very easily exasperated by me. For example, in teaching English, she was telling the difference between lie and lay. Lie is what a living thing does, and lay is what an inanimate object. So, for example, tell the dog to lie down, lay the book on the table. Well, I was enthusiastic. Ms. Burns, what about a potted plant? A potted plant is alive, but you have to lay it down. Oh, she got so exasperated with me. She took the chalkboard eraser and threw it up almost to the ceiling, and it hit a steam pipe almost at the ceiling. And there was a chalk dust print on that steam pipe for the rest of the year. But in science, she was ready for me. She got me. She was talking about the difference between a chemical change and a physical change. A physical change, like mixing salt and sugar, could be undone. But if you bake a cake, that's a chemical change. It can't be undone. Mrs. Burns, how do you unmix salt and sugar? Well, she was up to the task. She got a microscopic projector that could project onto the wall the salt and sugar crystals. So when projected in a large size, we could see that they were different. And so that we knew that if you had a microscopic projector and a toothpick and enough time, you could indeed unmix the salt and sugar. Well, many years go by, I grow up, I become a psychologist and a marriage counselor, and I see people now that think that their relationships are chemical changes, but they're really physical changes. And if they go through divorce proceedings and they hire attorneys, you know, they don't even need a toothpick. They can find a way to say what's yours and what's theirs if there's any money left by the time the attorney's finished. But people come to me as a therapist, and they they have a mistaken idea of what I do. They come to me thinking that I'm going to judge who is right in the relationship or who the sane person is. But I'm not a judge. I help people bake. So, you know, when that happens, when we see people that can really bake and connect together, there's a real change that happens. I call it we-ness, as opposed to me-ness focusing on me or you-ness focusing just on you. And that we-ness is a very powerful quality. And a lot of times when others see a couple with that, they're kind of jealous. Yes, we-ness envy is real. So, you know, this we-ness, in my own relationship with Kelly, who's here with me tonight in the studio, it didn't just happen. It happened over time. I remember, you know, when we first met, our first date, she was wearing this beautiful navy dress and a very tasteful, just a little bit of cleavage showing. And you know, it had this crystal necklace that was right above that cleavage. And I was trying not to stare at her cleavage, but that crystal necklace hypnotized me. So I just kind of had to look there. But you know, that wasn't when we really formed that chemical connection. And it wasn't on our honeymoon either, when we kind of spontaneously decided to get married and just drive down to Galveston. This was right before the 4th of July, and we thought we'll just get a hotel on the beach. And we'd go to Hotel Galvez, and they're like, well, do you have a reservation? No, we thought we'd just, well, we are completely booked. Okay, well, we drove to three more hotels, and there was nothing there. And finally, somebody told us, it's going to be a miracle if you find a room on the beach tonight. So we were kind of dejected, almost ready to drive back to Houston. But we thought, okay, we'll stop at this one last place, kind of dingy motel. But they had not only one, but two rooms available, which meant that our daughters who were with us could spend the night on our honeymoon in a separate room for us. So that was pretty special for everybody. But the next morning, we got up and there a flyer for a church had blown up against our car tire in the night. And it said, miracles happen. So maybe that was a miracle, but that wasn't the chemistry either. That wasn't when we really got baked together. You know, we've been together for over 20 years and we still get angry. We still get frustrated with each other at times. We don't ever think about leaving the relationship because we have this quality that says, whatever it is, we're going to get over it. So, you know, I really thank Mrs. Burns for teaching me about chemistry, and I thank Kelly for baking with me.
Chemistry, you know it when it's there, right? And Walter Blanchard certainly knew it when he met his wife.
I was a high school student, football player, good student, got some breaks along the way, and was able to, because of my athletics, take some extra credits in the summer so that I could have more time during the football season to practice and be there. I found myself in a class where my football coach was the teacher. And the pretty girl that sat across the room from me caught my attention. He noticed it too. And he said, you know, if you'd pay more attention to the civics lesson instead of that blonde girl, you'd probably do better in this class. I knew I was going to make an A anyway, but that's the way he talked to me. So I thought about this blonde girl, this beautiful girl. She was a senior. I also noticed that every time she left the class, some boy was carrying her books. And I came home that day and I told my mother, I said, boy, there's a great looking girl in my civics class and I'd love to ask her out. And my mother said, well, pick up the phone. I said, well, you don't understand. You see, I'm a junior and she's a senior and she might turn me down. She said, well, so what if she turned you down? I said, well, you don't grasp this. You know, everybody would know she turned me down because that's how the word gets out at the school. She said, and so what? I said, mother, you just don't get it like that. Well, one thing led to another, and one day after another, I watched that girl out of the corner of my eye, and every day she got prettier looking to me, and I kept thinking, I want to ask her out. And I would come home from time to time after school, and I told my mother, you know, I'm going to ask her out. But every time I reached for the phone, it weighed 1,000 pounds, and I couldn't pick it up. because I just feared the rejection. I was a fairly confident guy, but with girls, I was pretty shy. Well, one day I came home from school, and my mother and I were having a Coke there, and the phone rang, and she picked it up. And she said, well, yes, he's right here. Hang on. And my mother handed me the phone, and she said, it's Sue on the phone. And I thought, be still my heart. Sue, my goodness. So I took the phone, and someone said, and by the way, I'd never talked to that blonde girl, so I had no idea what her voice was like. She said, would you like to go to the big dance with me? I said, of course, without any hesitation. She said, well, you'll have to wear a tuxedo. And I said, no problem. And she said, well, that's great. Let's talk in the morning at school, and we'll solidify things. I said, okay, good. And boy, I put the phone down. I felt so great. My mother said, what happened? I said, the very girl I wanted to ask out, the very girl, you know, has called me to ask me out. She said, see what I mean? I mean, you know, why were you ever worried in the first place? So on the way to school the next morning with my friends, we drove together, and I told them that the senior, the most beautiful senior in the class, had asked me to the big dance. Well, these guys thought, man, I don't think you deserve that, but I'm glad you got it, and good for you. We used to meet in the cafeteria like all kids did at most high schools. Walked in that morning, I looked around, and I didn't see that girl, but another girl came walking up. And she said, I'm so glad that you agreed to go to the dance. It was another Sue. I couldn't believe it. My friends were laughing, and the girl said, what are they laughing about? I said, it's nothing, don't worry about that. She said, well, we'll go to the dance, and I'm going to give you my address, and here's my phone number. And I went, okay, great. They gave me a hard time. I went home that afternoon and told my mother that the wrong Sue had called me. She said, well, it's not the wrong Sue, it's just another Sue. I said, Mother, she said, you are going to take her to the dance. I said, no, I'll take her for sure. So I grumbled. The dance came, the day of the dance. I washed the car. I picked up the corsage I'd ordered for. I picked up the tuxedo. I dressed up. And I went to this girl's house. This girl was a year younger than me, so she was actually 2 years younger than the blonde girl I described earlier in the story. I knocked on the door. Her mother and father were there. I looked up at the top of the stairs. This was a different creature. She had her hair done, her fingernails. Her mother had built her a dress. She looked gorgeous. She came down the stairs with a beautiful smile. Her father took two rolls of film on an old Kodak camera with us, the same pose over and over again, with me smiling. We walked out to the car. We went to the dance. She was a delightful date. One thing led to another, and we went out to, dinner with some other people. I didn't know it, that we were going out to dinner, and frankly, I was completely broke by the time I had bought the corsage and rented the tuxedo. And somehow she sensed that. And despite everybody ordering lobster and other things, you know, we were all excited. You know, she turned to me and said, I'm not very hungry. How about you? And I said, not really. So we bought a $2 appetizer, you know, and shared it. And I took her home that night, kissed her on the steps. I know her parents were looking through the blinds. And she said, I've had the time of my life. And she walked inside. I felt great. I undid my bow tie. I drummed. Turned the windows down in the car. I drove around for a long time thinking about things. So when I came home that night, my mother was still up. She used to stay up for me. How was it? I said, it was great. She said, well, what about that other girl? I said, I'm going to call her tomorrow. I don't have any problem with that. I reached for that phone and called it. And that girl said, I'd be great. Be glad to go out with you. And so we went out. And now we've been married 50 years.
I'd like to try something a little different tonight. Maybe play a couple of songs designed to enhance a couple of these stories. Maybe not as artistically as Moon River at a prom dance, but still fun. You know, songs remind us of, well, everything romantic. Tunes that carry a recollection of a moment when love may not have been conquered, but certainly conquered us. You'd be hard-pressed to imagine that special girl or guy without a tune that we associate with them. When I think of Walter's deep love and unwavering commitment to his absolute love of his life, I think of a lot of great songs, but none as seemingly perfect as this sweet tune by the Seekers from 1960. Shifting for just a moment to love letters, because you know the Seekers is one of hundreds of artists over the years whose love songs smack of love letters with a beat. Love letters, no matter how they are composed, are stories which tend to spawn from moments frozen in time. Playwright A.J. Gurney's Love Letters, first performed in 1988, centers on two characters, Melissa Gardner and Andrew Makepeace Ladd III. They sit side by side at tables throughout the production, reading notes, letters, and cards in which over 50 years they discuss hopes and dreams. They never openly declare their love for one another. Still, it is apparent that their shared devotion comes from the trust that came from enduring every trajectory life has to offer and accepting it forever. Because of the story desire to be told, love letters can be long and frustrating to its writer, even to those who write for a living. Robert Browning to Elizabeth Barrett, for example, and F. Scott Fitzgerald to Zelda Zayer, Emily Dickinson to Susan Gilbert, John Keats to Fanny Braun. For other writers, letters are short and the story is clear. Here's an example, one from Winston Churchill to his darling Clementine. My darling Clemmy, you wrote some words very dear to me about my having enriched your life. I cannot tell you what pleasure this gave me, because I always feel so overwhelmingly in your debt. If there can be accounts in love, what it has been to me to live all these years in your heart and companionship, no phrases can possibly convey. Time passes swiftly. But is it not joyous to see how great and growing is the treasure we have gathered amid the storms and stresses of so many events and to millions tragic and terrible years? With tender love from your devoted Winston. Johnny Cash wrote this short one to June on her 65th birthday. And in 2015, it was awarded by Beagle Street as the most romantic letter ever written. Johnny Cash to June Carter. You still fascinate and inspire me. You influence me for the better. You're the object of my desire, the number one earthly reason for my existence. Wow. Well, this is Hank Rubicek, and I hope that you're enjoying an evening of sweet story and song on So What's Your Story, only on KPFT, Houston's Community Radio, 90.1 on the dial in Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. You know, what I love most about the Johnny Cash letter is it's proof that the one you love doesn't have to be far from you when you write it. A love letter is appropriate even when you're sleeping alongside your special someone every night. Story, song, letter, they all work. Of course, most love letters are written to connect with the love far away. And I think that perhaps soldiers demonstrate this purpose best. Reflect on this famous last letter written by Major Sullivan Ballou to his wife 1 week before he was killed at the Battle of Bull Run on July 21st, 1861.
Before the Battle of Bull Run, Sullivan Ballou, a major in the 2nd Rhode Island Volunteers, wrote home to his wife in Smithfield. July the 14th, 1861, Washington, D.C. Dear Sarah, the indications are very strong that we shall move in a few days, perhaps tomorrow. And lest I should not be able to write you again, I feel impelled to write a few lines that may fall under your eye when I am no more. I have no misgivings about or lack of confidence in the cause in which I am engaged, and my courage does not halt or falter. I know how American civilization now leans upon the triumph of the government, and how great a debt we owe to those who went before us through the blood and suffering of the revolution. And I am willing, perfectly willing, to lay down all my joys in this life to help maintain this government and to pay that debt. Sarah, my love for you is deathless. It seems to bind me with mighty cables that nothing but omnipotence can break. And yet my love of country comes over me like a strong wind and bears me irresistibly with all those chains to the battlefield. The memory of all the blissful moments I have enjoyed with you come crowding over me, and I feel most deeply grateful to God and you that I've enjoyed them for so long. And how hard it is for me to give them up and burn to ashes the hopes of future years, when, God willing, we might still have lived and loved together and see our boys grown up to honorable manhood around us. If I do not return, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I loved you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Forgive my many faults and the many pains I have caused you. How thoughtless, how foolish I have sometimes been. But oh, Sarah, if the dead can come back to this earth and flit unseen around those they love, I shall always be with you in the brightest day and the darkest night. Always. Always. And when the soft breeze fans your cheek, it shall be my breath, or the cool air, your throbbing temple. It shall be my spirit passing by. Sarah, do not mourn me dead. Think I am gone, and wait for me, for we shall meet again. Sullivan Ballou was killed a week later at the First Battle of Bull Run.
The power of a soldier's love is poignant and proud. If you get a hankering for more of these types of letters, check out Andrew Carroll's War Letters. You will love it, I promise. And I'll tell you what else I can promise. that the best place to develop your storytelling skills is by becoming a member of the Houston Storytellers Guild. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. with the next swap scheduled for Tuesday, February 23rd. Visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the Zoom link. And while you're on the site, enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs, all of them since 2008, listed on the menu under radio program. It's a quick reminder that So What's Your Story is a Houston original and the first storytelling platform in town. Now, currently, we're about the only place in town to bring you the art of telling, so why not make it a habit to tune in every week like so many of you already do? If you don't have a radio, that's not a problem because you can listen to our award-winning program stream live on kpft.org. Also, get to know us by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page and be sure to share it with your friends. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. If you've got any program ideas, guests, maybe even yourself, let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org and we promise to get back to you. Again, easy, story@kpft.org. Our friends at the Moth may not be packing into Warehouse Live, but they are alive and well. So please join them on their Facebook and enjoy their collection on themoth.org. And for anyone wanting to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Our focus on Valentine's continues next week when Tatiana Gago, that we miss her, hosts along with her extremely talented co-host, Maddie Leonard, who will debut next week. You know, so many love stories heard over the years highlight a gesture, a single solitary signal of love. Someone who paid attention, who listened. Wonderful storyteller and friend Jackie Ford captured it all in this story from February 7th, 2018.
My sister met her husband at an AA meeting. And I know that seems like an unlikely place for romance to bloom, but it actually always made perfect sense to me. Because otherwise, what could possibly explain how these two would have ever gotten together? And it seemed like the glue of AA itself and their shared commitment to dealing with their addiction and the commitment and the hard work and everything that that took, that made sense to me as a connection because otherwise they did not make any sense as a couple. They didn't make any sense just to look at the two of them as a pair. You'd think, what is she doing with him? You'd have to understand my sister Lynn was the most stunningly beautiful woman I ever saw. She had these amazing high cheekbones, perfect dimples, big green eyes, long lashes, black hair on top of her head. If you can remember Linda Carter, the actress who played Wonder Woman on television back in the day, my sister was a dead ringer for her, so much so that people would stop her on the street when we were in D.C. where Linda Carter lived. They would stop her on the street and ask her for an autograph, and Lynn would say, I can't sign that. I said, just sign it. Just sign it. L-Y-N-D. Just sign it. You'll give these people a great story they'll have for the rest of their lives. So she would do this, and this happened more than once. So this stunning, sophisticated, beautiful woman never left the house without her hair and makeup done, wouldn't pick up the mail without her hair and makeup done. This gorgeous woman marries a guy who's a plumber and pipe fitter. Nothing remarkable about him, nothing remarkable. In fact, his most remarkable physical characteristic was a tattoo that ran from his elbow all the way down to his wrist, full frontal of a naked woman. Hardly the sort of thing that my sophisticated sister would think to be attracted to. And that's why I always kept coming back to this story of how they met at AA, because it just explains so much. And over the years, we spent a lot of time together, and I got closer and closer to both of them, and I adored them both. And then one February morning, terrible morning a couple of years ago, Lynn called me, and her voice was cracking. She was calling to tell me that David died of a massive heart attack. Certainly part of her died that day. And she asked me if I would give the eulogy for him, and I was very honored and said, of course I would do that. So I traveled to the town where they lived. 2 days later, I was getting ready to give the eulogy. And just before I was going to start, I thought, oh, I better check this with her. So I said, Lynn, is it okay if I tell the story about how you two met at AA? I mean, I know some people are private about that. Is it okay if I tell that? She said, what are you talking about? We didn't meet at an AA meeting. I said, what? What? You didn't? No, of course not. Who told you that? I said, honestly, I don't remember, but the whole family's always told that story. She's looking around at the family. She goes, that's not true. I knew him for a long time before we were in AA together. We didn't meet there. And I thought, oh gosh, there goes the whole eulogy. I'm going to have to rewrite in the next couple minutes. And I gave the eulogy, and I was all the more puzzled. Like, well, what brought you together? What attracted you to him then? So about a year and a half later, unfortunately, Lynn was the one who was leaving us. In some ways, she never got over Dave's death, and she always seemed to have this cloud around her, and this sadness seemed to always be in the wings. And sure enough, it turned out she had terminal ovarian cancer. And one of the last conversations I had with her, we were sitting together on the couch at her house a Saturday after Thanksgiving, and she was pale, and the cheekbones were just gone. Her cheeks were just sunken. And she was in her nightgown at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, no hair, no makeup, so you knew it was a pretty bad day. And we were sitting there just silently on the couch together, and we're not really talking about anything. And all of a sudden she says to me, you know, I guess I was pretty lucky. I said, what do you mean, lucky about what? She says, you know, the whole time we were married, every single morning, when it was time for me to go to work, Dave would go over, go out the garage, put the garage door up, turn my car on, take the car out of the garage, turn it around, back it back into the garage, and then come back in, leave the car running so that I'd have a warm car to get into and I wouldn't have to back down that long driveway. He did that for me every day. And I realized what she was telling me was that was what attracted her to him. That was the secret of that marriage and that long relationship. It was a very simple thing. That man loved my sister.
Jackie is so good. You know, whenever I listen to her stories in particular, they always remind me of something. You know, stories work that way. They're so dynamic. They serve as, you know, these synergistic thought processes, and they're just, I always find them to be so magical in so many ways. But when I hear that story, the one we just heard from Jackie, I'm always reminded of my friends, Bob and Julie. They were an unbelievable couple. I met them when I was a master's degree student many, many years ago at Purdue University. We befriended each other. They kind of took care of me. They invited me over for dinner all the time. They were a magnificent couple, and they were really terrific mentors. And you know what they did? Every time they had dinner, and I mean every time, we're talking every night. At first, I thought they did it just for me, but turns out this was a daily routine. When they made dinner together, Bob would put on some soft music. And if you've never danced slow music, you have no idea what you're missing. And these two demonstrated that. So Bob would put on this really soft music, and I'd watch them do this. They would dance in the kitchen while they were preparing dinner, okay? So I watched this for a lot of time, a lot of years. And we kept in touch after we left Purdue. I actually watched them do it for about 2.5 years. And the years later, I ended up in College Park, Maryland. I was working on my doctoral degree at the University of Maryland. And Julie and Bob lived in Philadelphia. They had moved to Philadelphia. Julie had a professorial position at Temple University, and Bob was teaching at a private high school. In 1981, I get a call from Julie. Bob died. He had a heart attack. I didn't know anything more than that, but I was so devastated. I don't remember the reason, but I couldn't attend the funeral. But I did get to Julie's house a few hours after the service. I remember walking into their house, family and friends, so many of them were talking with each other. And after about 30 minutes of issuing my personal condolences, listening to and enjoying stories about Bob, all of them capturing the essence of his good nature, romantic, kind. Some stories really nailed his enduring an endearing disposition, a constant, reliable, humorous, junior high-like innocence and silliness that everyone loved. After a while, Julie gestured to me, asking me to come into the kitchen to talk. And I did, and she said, this was his favorite room. I knew what she meant, that relentless desire to dance while they were preparing dinner. I saw it so many times. And she said, the day Bob died, she wanted to make dinner and she wasn't in a great mood, and Bob, as always, wanted to dance. I brushed him off, she said. It kind of surprised him, but he said to me, if you don't want to dance, that's fine. I'm going to take a quick nap before dinner. So about an hour later, she tells me, I went into our bedroom to wake him up, and he was dead. I was numb, she said. She started to cry almost uncontrollably, and I watched her, and I held her, and then I began crying myself. And after a few minutes, she took a deep breath, and she said to me in a crackling, tear-drenched voice, if he were here right now, and he wanted to dance with me, I would dance with him, and I would never stop. And if I was cooking anything, I would let everything burn. Well, you know, for Bob and Julie, and anyone with a heart and a pulse, Johnny Rivers, Sway Into the Music.
Yeah.
What do you think, boomers? Slow dancing. Bring back any memories? Just wanted to let you know that we have some terrific guests scheduled for 2021 here on So What's Your Story. Also, a reminder, please do visit our Facebook page to get information on the monthly story swaps held by the Houston Storytellers Guild. And also, the Tejas Storytelling Association has a festival in March. Registration is on our page. Yours truly will be a teller at one of their concerts, and I'm really pretty stoked. I'm pretty excited about that. So love it if you could join us. It's all virtual. Dear friend and co-host Eric Heen has a way with words and an astonishing way with romance. You are going to love this story.
More romantic. So I thought about it, and I thought, nah. But then one day, this romance issue just exploded. It was when Katie went out of town to visit her parents for a week. And the first day she was gone, I was cleaning some clutter out of our storeroom. And from way deep in the back corner, I unearthed a box full of romance novels. I felt like my wife was cheating on me. Like she needed some fictional romance heroes to fulfill her needs. But then something struck me. There, at my fingertips, lay a treasure trove of forbidden female secrets. And I had an entire week to decode them. I could show Katie a real romance hero. So I took the box to my living room. Over the next 7 days, whenever I had a chance, I'd study these things to learn once and for all what it is that women want from men. It was the most baffling week of my life. I'm thumbing through the first novel. I come to this scene where some guy named Magnus swoops a woman named Elizabetha into his arms and spins her around. So I say, okay. So I make a note of that. And I practice this swooping maneuver to use on Katie. Used our basset hound. Well, as I was reading these, I began to notice something funny about the dialogue. Now, people haven't spoken like this for like 600 years. The men were using words like cherub and quenchless inferno. So I made a note of that. I began learning this archaic love language. Oh, and they'd always sneak a little bit of French in there. Just out of the blue. Mon chéri, la t'aime, blah, blah, blah. So I learned a little bit of French. And then there was the sex. These weren't like novels from the 1920s. These were contemporary. These were lurid. And the men in these books set the bar pretty high. And too high. And they never just go right in for the big shebang. These guys would carry on forever with nuzzling and nibbling and caressing and forever. In this one book, some fireman named Devlin. He went on nuzzling and nibbling for 20 pages. So I made a note of that. And I practice nuzzling and nibbling at nighttime with my pillow. Well, by the end of the week, I was ready to dazzle Katie with my newfound romance skills. Sunday night, I meet her at the door. Long-stemmed rose clenched in my teeth. I hand her the rose and I say, "Welcome home, my cherub." Then I lead her into the living room and I swoop her into my arms. Now this hurt my back, but the pain made me feel like a martyr for love. I hobble over to the sofa and I plop her down and I sit next to her. I look her in the eyes and I say, "Moi je que t'es là, moi, la de la bleue." I start getting ready for the nibbling and the nuzzling. Then Katie looks at me and she says, "I see you found my romance novels." Well, right then, I gave up the charade. I'm just me. I'm not a romance hero. I'll never be able to swoop her into my arms like Magnus, speak French like Pierre, or go on in bed for 20 pages like Devlin. Then Katie scooted up to me and she said, "Eric, I wouldn't trade you for all those romance heroes in the world." Quenchless inferno. Thank you.
If you ever have a hard time smiling, just think of and listen to Eric Hain. That is one skilled teller. So it's Valentine's Day coming up, right? Peeps, weeps, and memories for keeps. So here are a few heart-rending quips. This one is by Victor Hugo. "Life is a flower for which love is the honey. Love recognizes no barriers. It just jumps hurdles, leaps fences, penetrates walls to arrive at its destination full of hope." Maya Angelou. This one is Emily Bronte from Wuthering Heights. "Whatever souls are made of his and mine are the same." Herman Hesse. "If I know what love is, it's because of you." Zelda Fitzgerald in one of the love letters to her husband, F. Scott. "Nobody's ever measured, not even poets, how much the heart can hold." Pablo Picasso. "Love is the greatest refreshment in life." So simple, some of these, huh? Vincent van Gogh. "Love is something eternal. The aspect may change, but not the essence." And this is my personal favorite, by A.A. Milne. And this is, in my judgment, the most romantic line ever articulated by a gentleman. "If you live to be 100, I want to live 100 minus one day, so I never have to live without you." Pretty beautiful, huh? I mean, that is beautiful. My gosh. You know, sometimes the best way to gauge life and love is to pay attention to elderly couples, right? There was this one couple who, the gentleman is near death, and he turns to his wife and he says, "You know, Sarah, do you remember when we get married, we were broke, we were always broke, but still you were always here next to me?" Yes, Harry, I remember. "Remember our sons, well, they didn't turn out so great, right? They didn't turn out so great at all. We ended up supporting them till they were 52, for God's sakes. But still, you were always here next to me. You remember that, Sarah?" Yes, Harry, I remember. "We go bankrupt. Remember, we go bankrupt. We lose the store. I lose the haberdashery. We lose our house. But still, in all of that, you still were always there next to me. You remember? Yes, Harry, I remember. Absolutely, I remember. Well, Sarah, here I am. I got plugs through my nose, my throat. I got sicknesses like I never dreamed possible. I'm going any moment. And you know something? You are a jinx. Okay. Okay, in the meantime, who? Funny? I don't know. Okay, so I thought you might enjoy that one. Doesn't get any better than this, I hope you agree. These stories are magnificent. We love spending every Thursday with you on So What's Your Story? Houston's Community Radio. So there you have it for tonight, just a smidgen of our sweet tales of romance. Speaking of sweet, don't you dare touch that dial, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters. We want you to make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and we're going to keep bringing them to you. This is Hank Rubicek, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. And as a sign-off tonight, I want to play for you Eric Harmon, Make Me Lose Control. Peace.
Step out in the street, and the city's the color of green, the midsummer breeze. Jennifer's got daddy's car, she's playing uptown on the stereo. We go cruising so close, way they did long ago.
Oh, It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to start with the word groundhog, add the two-letter abbreviation for a state where winter might be over, and rearrange the letters to get two mythical creatures. Well, my intended answer was groundhog plus A-L for Alabama. Rearrange the letters and you get dragon and ghoul. And as a couple of listeners pointed out, that can just as well be L-A for Louisiana. Our winner this week is Molly Spees, who listens to KPOV in Bend, Oregon.
A two and a rock and a two and a log. Good Lord, mercy, what a big groundhog, groundhog.
For the new puzzle, I have a spin-off from last week's Weekend Edition puzzle, which was about letters and children. What four letters from the modern English alphabet, said aloud phonetically, create an adjective that could be used to describe childhood? For example, if you say the letter K and the letter G, you get the word cagey. So again, I'm looking for four letters which, said aloud, become an adjective that could be used to describe childhood. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday.
A child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way, but there were planes to catch.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of February 1st. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV, High Desert Community Radio.
Listener contributions play an extremely important role in the quality of the music and news you hear on this station. If you've never made a contribution to KPFT, we need to hear from you. With the threat of reduced federal funding for public radio, first-time contributors are more important now than ever. Call 713-526-5738 now to make your tax-deductible contribution or pledge online at kpft.org. We need your pledge. You make a huge difference in this radio station when you pledge to KPFT. Again, that number is 713-526-KPFT. Call and make your tax-deductible contribution today. You can also pledge online at kpft.org. This is commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio. KPFT, Houston.
First, you listen.